fiddle music. 2009 track from Otomo Yoshi Hide. Some music off of a compilation of modern music from Southwest Madagascar. Some really cool, upbeat, kind of psych dance guitar solo music. Really cool stuff. I always butcher this name, but I love the music. Antonio Infantino ed E. Tarantolati de Tricarico. Some really cool kind of pagan folk music from Italy, 1978. Folly del Divino Spirito Santo is the name of the album. Yeah, thanks for tuning in, folks. This has been an experiment with time on WRCT Pittsburgh. Have a great night. Take care of yourselves.
WRCT Pittsburgh, and this is the stormy weather.
Before we get started, I'd like to remind you that the views, thoughts, and opinions expressed in this show are solely those of individuals involved and do not necessarily represent those of WRCT Pittsburgh and its members.
A nuclear winter from the war between the United States and Russia and China would probably get you within about 1% of what happened to the dinosaurs. You've probably all heard politicians say a nuclear war cannot be won and should never be fought. They all say that, but do they understand it? Do they actually mean that? Or is that just lip service?
That's Brian Toon, and this is Alternative Radio. I'm David Barsamyan. This edition of AR features Brian Toon on dinosaurs, extinctions, and nuclear war. Millions of years ago, a huge asteroid hit what is now the Yucatan Peninsula in Mexico. The global forests and grasslands burned. The smoke from the resulting fires marks one of the greatest extinctions in Earth's history, including not just dinosaurs, but also fish, plankton, and plants. Today, a war with just a few of the world's thousands of nuclear weapons targeted on densely populated cities could plunge Earth into the same types of conditions that the dinosaurs experienced. A war involving Russia, NATO, and the United States could kill billions of people. And what is the U.S. doing? It is upgrading and modernizing all components of its nuclear weapons arsenal at a cost of over $1 trillion. With the possibility of nuclear war, humans may end up like the dinosaurs. Our guest today is Brian Toon. He's Professor Emeritus in the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences and the Laboratory for Atmospheric and Space Physics at the University of Colorado at Boulder. He's an award-winning scholar and co-author of Earth in Flames. He spoke in Boulder, Colorado in late August. And now, Brian Toon.
Thank you for inviting me to talk to you. So today, I'm going to tell you about the extinction of the dinosaurs and what might happen to you in a nuclear war. So you might think this is odd, and what have these things got to do with each other? So one of the thoughts I want to leave you with is that they seem to have a common potential cause. 66 million years ago, an asteroid about as big as Mount Everest smacked into the Yucatan Peninsula at about 20 times the velocity of the fastest rifle bullet, releasing an energy of about 100,000 million tons of TNT, far larger than any nuclear arsenal we have. Following that, everything on the surface of the Earth burned and caught fire. The smoke from that and the fires are what caused the extinctions. How about a nuclear winter? How about a nuclear war? In a nuclear war, there will be thousands of burning cities across the globe. Those cities burning would, of course, kill many people who live in the cities, but the smoke would go into the upper atmosphere, spread across the Earth, black out the sun, and start freezing temperatures at mid-latitudes, continuing on for years, which would lead to global starvation. We estimate that by the end of the second year, a war between the United States, Russia, and China would leave about 5% of the human population in the United States, Canada, Russia, China, Middle East, and Europe. Okay, so what do we know about extinctions? This comes from a bunch of geologists who like to go around and hack at rocks and look at the edges of cliffs. And when you look at the side of a cliff face, well, you often see layers of rocks. And so the geologists will go and look at those layers of rocks and the fossils that are in them. And they can tell how old they are from that. And so what they have noticed is that sometimes the fossils change. So you have to think about the organization of living organisms. So the most restrictive thing is a species. So we're all Homo sapiens. The next thing up is a genus. We're the only species in our genus, but there used to be other species, not that long ago, actually, of Neanderthals, Denisovians, and Florenzians. There are quite a few Homos on the planet, not that long ago. A family, we're in the family of great apes with gorillas. So the average lifetime of a mammal species on the Earth is about 1 million years. So you can't really do extinctions very easily with species because they don't last very long, which doesn't bode well for us. We've already been around 200,000 years. We may not make it that much longer. Okay, so what the geologists do is they look at the extinction rate. How many families disappear in 1 million years? And so you can see there's a constant background level of extinctions, about 5 families per 1 million years. But there are occasionally times when 10 to 20 families go extinct in a smaller frame time frame. There's one of them about 400 and 500 million years ago, another one around 400 million. This is a really big one, about 250. This is where the dinosaurs arose after this extinction. So they are the product of an extinction. And they took over the world at this extinction. Mammals arose at the same time. So our ancestors have been on the planet as long as the dinosaurs, more than 100 million years. This is the event 66 million years ago when the dinosaurs became extinct and the mammals first really took over control. So you're here because of an accident of a rock hitting the planet. So it's thought that about 95% of the species on the planet died in this event. So as far as we know, these extinctions here were caused by volcanic activity, pumping up carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. On the other hand, the extinction 66 million years ago, there's quite a bit of material left to know about that one. And that killed about 75% of the species on the planet. Here's another one. This one is caused by us. And so you probably know that people are taking over the Earth. On the average person has about 2 football fields of land to have your house on, grow your crops on, have your forests and deserts and things like that on. You've got 2 football fields shared with everybody else on the planet. So we're pushing all the other animals off, like the elephants and other creatures are dying out. So this appears to be a mass extinction that we're in the middle of here. Okay, so these mass extinctions, we'd like to know more about them. This extinction was much more than the dinosaurs. 75% of the species on the planet died. It wasn't just dinosaurs, it was 94% of the mammals. There were extinctions in the oceans of lots of fish and plankton and things like that. It's very unlikely they caught the flu. So what did cause the extinction? So Harold Urey, who was a Nobel Prize winning chemist, suggested that extinctions would occur because of asteroids hitting the planet, because he thought the timing of extinctions was about the same as the timing of big asteroids hitting the planet. Nobody paid any attention to this idea. There was a little thin strata here that you could put your hand on where the dinosaur extinction happened. Of course, this wasn't marked by dinosaur bones sticking out because they're very rare. It was marked by plankton and things like that, which are very numerous and easy to find. There is a constant rain of stuff coming into the Earth's atmosphere. There's about 40 tons of micrometeorites, tiny little meteorites, coming into the Earth every day. They're hitting the roof of this building. If you wanted to, you could go drag magnets on it. You might find a few of them. So they knew about this, and they figured, well, we can time how long it took to put this little layer down. And they were going to do it by seeing how much micrometeorites were there. Micrometeorites come from space on undifferentiated asteroids. On the Earth, the core of the Earth formed early in its history, and iridium went to the core along with iron. So it's depleted in the crust of the Earth. But it's very common in asteroids. So you could look for iridium, an element, and tell how many asteroids were in a thin layer. So they did that, and they discovered to their surprise that the layer was almost entirely asteroid. And from the amount of iridium, they could tell the size of the asteroid, which is about the size of Mount Everest, about 10 kilometers in diameter. And it probably hit, as I said, at about 20 times the speed of the fastest bullet. It took quite a while, a decade or so, to find the crater. People thought the crater may have never been found because of C4 spreading and loss. But in fact, it hit in the Yucatan Peninsula, which at the time was underwater. So when the asteroid, which is about 500 cubic kilometers of material, hit Mexico, there was such a strong shock wave that it vaporized the asteroid in about an equal mass of Mexico. This vapor, rock vapor, probably spread 1,000 kilometers above the Earth. We saw this happen on Jupiter, spread to huge heights, spread out because it was a gas of rock, and as it cooled, it condensed and formed spheres. And these things re-entered the atmosphere as little shooting stars. So you've probably all seen shooting stars in a shooting star storm. You might see one a minute. In this case, there are 10,000 shooting stars on the ground, where it's preserved in the geologic layers, 10,000 shooting stars still preserved per square centimeter. You know, twice that much per square inch or something. That's a lot. So it wasn't just a few things flashing through the sky. It was a whole swarm of them. The most surprising thing in this layer is soot. So elemental carbon, black carbon, soot, is you see it around your fireplace. You've got a wood-burning fireplace. It all turns black at the edges. That's what this is. And the stuff that's found in this layer looks exactly the same as what you see from forest fires today. There's a lot of this stuff in the boundary layer, about 50,000 million tons of soot. You had to burn everything on the surface of the planet to create that much soot. So as far as we can tell, everything on the surface caught fire. What probably did happen looks like what you see in a fire, in a forest, an intense fire. The sky is a glowing red gas. And of course, everything catches fire from the glow from the air. So this sand-sized spheres probably started everything on fire. How did they do that? When they re-enter the Earth's atmosphere, they came in just like shooting stars. You've seen the trail behind shooting stars. That's because of friction with the air, and the shooting star is coming in at huge velocities. It gets very hot and vaporizes and leaves behind a hot trail of vaporized rock. Well, these things from the asteroid weren't coming in quite that fast, so they didn't vaporize. but they did heat up the upper atmosphere. So the air above about 60 kilometers or so was probably at about 2,000 degrees centigrade, 3,000 Fahrenheit or something like that, 2,000 degrees centigrade. That would be like standing in front of a red hot sheet of lava if you were exposed to that. It's not like point source. The sun is a point source. There are shadows. The whole sky here is glowing red. There are no shadows. So there's no way that a dinosaur could get away from this. So the dinosaurs are not the whole story. There's lots of other land creatures there. Probably many of them died the same way, not being able to hide from these global fires. But there's also a mass extinction in the oceans. Obviously, the oceans didn't catch on fire. So what happened there? The extinction in the oceans was caused because the lights went out. All this smoke from all these global fires in the stratosphere reduced light levels to 100 millionth of what we normally see. So this is kind of a surprising thing about human beings is your eyes are logarithmic. You can actually see light levels 100 millionth down. If you go out on a moonless night, the light levels are around 100 millionth of normal. Cameras are not logarithmic, they're linear. They can't see once you get just a few percent of light. And photosynthesis is not logarithmic. Photosynthesis only works at light levels above about 1% of normal. So that's what happened is all that smoke blotted out the sun and the photosynthesis stopped and then everything died in the oceans. How did we survive? How did our ancestors survive this? So there's some avian dinosaurs that made it through. They probably were like parrots, some of whom live in termite mounds. Our ancestors at the time were like little mice. You know, we were the kings of the small world and the dinosaurs were the kings of the big world. We were not out-competing the dinosaurs. We've been around for 100 million years with them. We weren't getting anywhere. And this asteroid killed the dinosaurs, and we took over. Dale Russell, who was at the Canadian Natural History Museum, made a statue of what he thought would be here without the asteroid collision. So he envisioned that there was a dinosaur, they're in a group called Troodons. You see a lot of these as velociraptors in dinosaur movies, they're little small things running around viciously attacking stuff. The Troodons are actually about as big as a turkey. At any rate, he thought this was about the smartest dinosaur based on the size of its brain. So we thought it was about as smart as an ostrich or an armadillo. Armadillos are not too bright to get run over by cars all the time and get made into purses. But he thought that over time that they would evolve to have a big brain and they would still retain about three fingers. And he thought that they would develop a belly button so that they could have live birth. And so possibly this is who would be here now if it hadn't been for this event. So let's turn our attention now to nuclear wars. Nuclear weapons were developed in the Second World War. In 1945, at the end of the war, there were a couple of weapons that had been dropped on Hiroshima and almost none left. By the 1960s, the mid-1960s is when I graduated from high school, 1965, there were about 40,000 on the planet, 30,000 of them in the United States, and maybe 10,000 in Russia. And by 1985, there were 65,000 nuclear weapons on the planet, 40,000 in Russia, and we were down to 25,000 then. Right now, there are more than 10,000 left, and in the arsenals of both Russia and the United States, each of them have about 4,000. 2,000 of these are deployed, ready to be used. Okay, so something obviously happened here in around 1985 to cause this big build-out. So at this time, there were 60,000 nuclear weapons on the planet. There are only 500 cities between Russia and the United States, 300 in the United States with more than 100,000 people, bigger than Boulder. Boulder's about 100,000. 300 cities. There's only 200 cities that are big in Russia. Russia's got the population of about Japan. That's half the population of the United States even though it's the biggest country in Asia and Europe and in the world. At any rate, if you take 60,600 and divide by 5, you know, that's like more than 100 weapons on each tiny little town. You only need one weapon to destroy a town like Boulder. How many weapons are aimed at Boulder? Well, right now, we have 2,000 each, 4,000 total weapons. 8 nuclear weapons could be used to attack every city in Russia and the U.S. with more than 100,000 people with 8 nuclear weapons. In most towns the size of Boulder, there's nothing worth attacking with 8 nuclear weapons, let alone 1 nuclear weapon. But it's easy to find out where the weapons are aimed at Boulder. There are weapons aimed at you right now. There's plenty of weapons going around here to destroy all the cities in Russia and the U.S. Okay, so what happened here is that Ronald Reagan and Mikhail Gorbachev decided they'd had enough. So for those of you who remember the Reagan administration, he had proposed Star Wars as a golden dome, which is what Trump is now proposing, to protect us from missile attacks. And so he appeared to be a dangerous president who might drag us into a war. So here's what Gorbachev and Reagan said about that peak. They said, models, climate models made by Russian and American scientists showed that a nuclear war would result in a nuclear winter that would be extremely destructive to all life on Earth. The knowledge of that was a great stimulus to us, to people of honor and morality, to act in that situation. A great many reputable scientists are telling us that such a war could just end up in no victory for anyone because we would wipe out the Earth as we know it. And if you think back to natural calamities, back in the last century in the 1800s, volcanoes, we saw the weather so change that there was snow in July in many temperate countries, and they called it the year in which there was no summer. Now, if one volcano can do that, what are we talking about with the whole nuclear exchange? The nuclear winter that scientists have been talking about, it's possible. So Reagan actually wanted to get rid of nuclear weapons, and he and Gorbachev actually agreed to get rid of them, but they were prevented by their advisors from doing so. But they did start a build-down of nuclear weapons. And that build-down of nuclear weapons has continued ever since then. Every American president since then and every Russian leader since then has reduced nuclear weapons until the Biden administration. And so this build-down has stopped. The agreement that Reagan and Gorbachev put in place was to eliminate short-range nuclear missiles in Europe, which were a great threat to Europe, obviously. Donald Trump eliminated that treaty in his first term. So we only have one treaty left. It expires in February of next year. That's limiting nuclear armaments. And the Obama administration, to get a treaty that really was not of much value, he agreed to give the military and the Department of Energy $1 trillion to build up nuclear weapons. So there's a huge nuclear weapon refurbishment going on in the United States involving new plutonium for nuclear weapons and a whole bunch of other things. The Russians are doing the same thing. In fact, the Russians violated the treaty, which is why Trump walked away from it, by producing missiles that could still attack Europe, and they have thousands of those. At any rate, everybody has been following this downward path, and we've leveled off now. However, there is hope for something to happen here, because Donald Trump doesn't like all this money being wasted on nuclear weapons. He didn't know much about nuclear weapons in his first term. Someone told him they were useless. And he said, well, why are we putting all this money into nuclear weapons? So if we can ever solve the Ukrainian problem, there's some hope that Putin and Trump can reach an agreement to eliminate more of these weapons. There are other countries also have nuclear weapons. So from the 1970s up until recently, the number of these was pretty flat, around a few hundred weapons in France and the United Kingdom and China, Israel, India, Pakistan, and North Korea. But right now, there's a big expansion going on. So So when Gorbachev and Reagan reached their agreement, everybody stopped building them. But now they're starting to build them again. So China is ramping up its arsenals so that they're similar to those in the U.S. and Russia. They're around 500 now. North Korea's got an arsenal. No one knows how big it is, but it's probably around 50. And India and Pakistan have weapons that are thought to be around 150 or so each. So there's lots of weapons out there in other countries, which makes this a political nightmare because they all have different interests. This was something that worried Kennedy. In the 60s, he thought there would be dozens of nuclear states by now, which there are not, but it is expanding. So what happens if a nuclear explosion occurs? So if you look at pictures of Hiroshima after the bomb fell, there are some standing concrete structures, but most of the area for about a mile around that just looked like burned out rubble. And that's not from the shockwave from the bomb. It's from a fire that started in all the wooden buildings there. The same thing is true of Nagasaki. That was how the Second World War ended. The United States firebombed 60 Japanese cities, as well as Hamburg and Dresden and a couple other places in Europe. And the war ended. So it's a fire that happened. And we know this happened because the Japanese took pictures of it. There are pictures of the firestorm, which started about 3 hours after the bomb fell. And in the museum there, there's a stucco wall that has black stripes of radioactive soot from a black rain that fell on Hiroshima after this event. There's also pictures from airplanes that flew over a little bit after the explosion, and they took pictures of the smoke cloud. So this is a big thunderstorm. It was a big thunderstorm. These are called pyrocumulus or pyro-CBs. They're happening in fires in Canada now. There was one in British Columbia in 2017 that was about as tall as this one. There's another one in Australia in 2020 that was about as big as this one. This one was above the altitude of the airplane. Guess that this is in the lower stratosphere, probably somewhere around 16 kilometers above the ground. Why does this matter? If you have a normal forest fire, like the ones from Canada and stuff we're suffering from in the last few years, the smoke stays in the lower atmosphere where we live, called the troposphere. And it just blows along, and after a week or two, it gets rained out when it hits a rainstorm. But if smoke goes into the stratosphere, it never rains. So how many of you have been in the stratosphere? Probably you've all been in the stratosphere. If you fly in a commercial airliner, they go in the stratosphere almost all the time when they're cruising. So you can all put your hands up. You've been in the stratosphere. It doesn't rain in the stratosphere. And so you put stuff in the stratosphere, it will stay there for years. So people have modeled this for an imaginary war between India and Pakistan. So in a war like this, of course, there's a lot of smoke generated from burning cities in India and Pakistan. And this imaginary war started in the computer on the 15th of May. By the 1st of June, the smoke has spread all the way across the northern hemisphere. And by a month, it spread deep into the southern hemisphere. And because it's black smoke, when the sun shines on it, it heats it. And the air rises. We've actually seen this happen in 2017 and 2020 for the first time after big fires put smoke in the stratosphere. The smoke rose up to 20 or 30 kilometers altitude. We could see it for a year with satellites. And we see numbers here like a tenth. That means a tenth of all the photons coming into the atmosphere are being absorbed by that black carbon or soot. So we can look at this in a little more detail, a little scarier detail. So this is a war between the United States and Russia and China. And we're looking here at what happens in Iowa and the Ukraine. We pick those two places because they're the breadbaskets of the U.S. and Russia and Europe. We want them to be able to grow food. So in January, in a normal year, it's cold, and so you're in winter, and the temperature is below freezing. And as spring comes along, it warms up, and by the middle of the summer, the minimum daily temperature, the lowest temperature of the day, is around 15 degrees centigrade, you know, which is a nice enough temperature. And then in the fall, it drops below freezing again, comes back up warm, and then it goes back down as cold. in this calculation, what happens is when this war starts, the temperature immediately starts dropping. By the early fall, the temperatures are below freezing. All the next winter, they're below freezing. All the next summer, they're below freezing. All the winter after that, they're below freezing. It's only in the second summer after this war that you start to get a few days with the lowest daily temperature above freezing. You're not going to grow anything in this kind of a situation. The other thing that happens is a global ozone hole. So right now we have an ozone hole. If you make a map of where the ozone is, you see a little blue ring in the color diagrams people use, marking the ozone hole over Antarctica, which is still there and probably going to last to the middle of this century. When you do this calculation following the war, the ozone hole becomes global. This is not good because ozone protects us from ultraviolet light. You wouldn't be able to walk outside of your house for very long with these kinds of ozone levels. We have no idea what this would do to crops and animals who can't go into houses because we've never seen anything on the planet like this.
You're listening to Brian Toon on Dinosaurs, Extinctions, and Nuclear War. This is Independent Alternative Radio. For copies of this program, call us 1-800-444-1977 or online our website, alternativeradio.org.
Okay, so we know a lot about agriculture. It's big money. There's all kinds of numerical models for agriculture that try to figure out what's going to happen to food if it gets warmer next year or colder next year. And so they've looked at this with a model that can look at the crops that are produced in every country in the world and ask what would happen to them if it got cold. Why is it going to get cold? Because the sunlight is all being absorbed in the stratosphere. It's not getting to the ground. You see this every day. Right now, it's nighttime. It's colder outside than it was in the daytime. Winter is sort of starting to come, and we all know it will get cold in the winter. Climate models know how to simulate day and night, and they know how to simulate summer and winter. This is not a difficult calculation. If the sun goes away, it gets cold. So a war between India and Pakistan, we don't know how many weapons they have for sure, and we don't know how big their weapons are. They could be very small, like the Hiroshima weapon, or they could be big, like the ones that North Korea has tested and that we commonly have in our arsenals. So that produces some uncertainty. For the smallest yield weapons, we think about 1 billion people globally would die in a war between India and Pakistan. In India and Pakistan, we think the deaths there would only be on the order of somewhere between 500,000 and 1 million. So the deaths from the bombs blowing up is not very high. The deaths globally from starvation is a significant fraction of the world population, which is currently about 8 billion people. So in Canada, 95% of the people would starve to death. In the United States, 25 to 50% of the population would starve to death. In Russia, about 75% to 95% would starve to death by the second year, which is not even the worst. The climate continues to get worse to about 3 or 4 years, and it takes almost 10 years to recover. And we made some very optimistic assumptions here. We assume that the amount of food that's left that can be grown locally, there's no transport assumed here, no food is shipped in. But currently, the world survives on food transport. And you may remember that maybe it was 10 years ago here, we had a big snowstorm just before Christmas. The grocery stores had nothing to eat in them within a day or so. And we started to run out of gasoline because people couldn't get into town with those materials. So the cities, on the average, have about 7 days of food and storage in them. If you don't keep bringing food into Boulder in 7 days, everybody gets hungry. Probably everybody has heard the story, which is in the Bible and in the Quran, about the Pharaoh and the cows. How many of you heard the story of the Pharaoh and the cows? So there's a guy in prison in Egypt, and he was telling everybody what their dreams meant. And the Pharaoh was dreaming about cows, and he didn't know why was he dreaming about cows. So he went to, I think, David, and I get my characters mixed up in this. The Pharaoh said, well, what does this cow dream mean? David said, it means there's going to be 7 good years, and you should store up food for 7 years. And there's going to be 7 bad years, and then you can feed the Egyptian population. As this was a big success, and the Pharaoh, who had evidently a 14-year term, was very happy. This is not true of the modern world. In the modern world, there's 60 days of grain in storage. 60 days. If you don't keep growing grain continuously, starvation happens. For example, Russia often has wheat failures. In the Carter administration, we sent them in Russia, Soviet Union, a significant fraction of all of our wheat, because otherwise they were going to starve to death. In the Middle East, you may recall in the last few years, there were food riots going on, which led to this overthrow of a bunch of governments there, including in Syria. That was all driven by crop losses going on in Russia and other places, and they stopped transferring as much food there. And those people spent a lot of their salary on food. So 60 days of food is what we have. That's why this is really dangerous, not just for nuclear wars, but also for some other global events that could stop trade of food. Okay, what happens if there's a war between the United States and Russia? If there were a war between the United States and Russia, 95% of the population is predicted to die. In Canada, the United States, Russia, China, the Middle East, and Europe, 95% of the population would starve to death. And I started to mention that we had an assumption in here, not just about trading food. We also assumed that the food that you need to stay alive, so the 5% are surviving, they get all the food. And the 95% of the people get nothing. That's not going to happen. The 95% of the people are going to kill the 5% of the people, and then they'll all starve to death. Okay, so what do we know here, besides the fact you're probably depressed now? So we have this problem bounded. On the small end of smoke going into the stratosphere, there's about 1% of 1 million tons of smoke from these big forest fires going into the stratosphere. This warmed the stratosphere up. We could see it in satellites for about a year afterwards. It didn't do anything to the ground because there wasn't that much of it. We have the problem bounded on the other end from the dinosaurs. There was about 50,000 million tons of smoke in the stratosphere there. The sun was obliterated. There was not enough sunlight for photosynthesis, below 1% for a couple of years there. So that's another endpoint we have. The Pakistan-India case is probably a little over 100 times worse than these single fires in British Columbia and Australia. We think that would kill crops at mid-latitudes, like a farmer looking out at a field of corn that could never develop. So anyway, the sky would look black and the sun would barely be showing through it. A nuclear winter from a war between the United States and Russia and China would probably get you within about 1% of what happened to the dinosaurs. And it would probably look like snow-covered middle latitudes. You know, there would be nothing that you could grow there. There'd be snow on the ground from the low temperatures and ice everywhere. Nothing would grow. Okay, so where does this leave us? Right now, we can't stop an asteroid impact. But people are working on it, and a small one we probably could stop in a decade or so if we really tried it. I always find this amusing. So in the movies, what does a movie show? Does it show astronauts going to the asteroid and scientists figuring out what to do and engineers figuring out to help? No, it shows oil workers. Some of the people who make movies think the hard thing is to drill a hole in the asteroid and put a bomb in it. And of course, there's a girl oil driller and some boys, and they spend all the time fighting each other over the girl, and they barely blow it up and save the Earth. This is not possible. We couldn't blow up a significant sized asteroid, even with all the nuclear weapons on the planet. It also remains to be seen if we could prevent a nuclear conflict and global starvation. So history shows that the world scientific community can help eliminate nuclear weapons. I read the quotes to you from Gorbachev and Reagan. They both quoted their science establishments saying that they had to do something about all these nuclear weapons or they'd want to kill everybody on the planet. Okay, so you've probably all heard politicians say a nuclear war cannot be won and should never be fought. So all the politicians are trained to say that. They all say that. But do they understand it? Do they actually mean that? Or is that just lip service? So the goal of the group that I work with is to make sure the politicians know what I just showed you, to make sure that they're not paying lip service just to this. And as I mentioned already, this is not a hopeless situation, because I think there are good reasons to think that Donald Trump, in his quest to get a Nobel Peace Prize, might want to do something about this as soon as he solves the Ukraine war by negotiating a new treaty with Russia. Okay, thank you for your attention. I'd be happy to answer any questions you have about either one of these topics.
Will the bacteria survive?
Sure. There are lots of things that would survive a nuclear conflict. Cockroaches is the most common example people give. They're very resistant to radiation. And so there'll probably be a lot of creatures that reproduce very rapidly and have huge numbers of individuals out there that can regenerate the population. And there are places that are probably not as bad as others. New Zealand, Australia, and Argentina, for example. And the reason for that, let's take New Zealand as an example. So New Zealand grows a lot of sheep, which it exports, and the sheep eat grass, which is pretty resilient. So in a situation like this, New Zealand would just keep the sheep and they'd all eat sheep. Might get boring after a while. We had lamb for dinner, so I like that. But they could eat their sheep. But if you look into it more carefully, you discover that that doesn't actually work, because the people in New Zealand don't have the ability to make oil, so all their tractors and cars and stuff would pretty soon run out of gas, and they don't have the machinery to repair their generators, so it would fail there. Australia has got a similar situation, except they grow a lot of wheat, so they probably could feed their population. Probably the best thing to do is to go to Argentina. If they didn't kill you when you tried to get into Argentina, there might be enough stuff to eat there. Iceland looks like a good place to go in calculations because they fish a lot. But that's probably a mistake, because there's a big ice sheet that builds up around Iceland, and they wouldn't be able to get their ships out to actually go catch any fish, which happened to them in the Little Ice Age in the 1400s. So there are places, there are refugia that you have a better chance of living in.
Putin has talked about tactical nuclear weapons. Did you and your co-authors look at what use of those might do?
Sure. So what is a tactical nuclear weapon? There's two definitions of a tactical weapon. It's not a strategic weapon. The strategic ones are long-range missiles going across the globe. The tactical weapons can be carried on airplanes, on short-range missiles, on cruise missiles. They can have any size you want. The other definition of them is you don't know anything about them because they're not covered by treaty. Russia has about 2,000 tactical weapons. Many of them are mines and things like that on ships, but a lot of them are designed to be carried on airplanes like they're using against Ukraine. There are dual-use aircraft there, and on cruise missiles and on short-range missiles. So they would attack Europe with tactical weapons. Tactical weapons have the same yields as strategic weapons. And we have no idea. The United States now has about 5 tactical nuclear weapons. They're on a submarine. In the first Trump administration, he put 5 tactical weapons on a submarine. Why? No one knows why he did this. Some people think he wants to use a nuclear weapon so he can break the taboo against the use of nuclear weapons. Other people think he just thought they'd be handy if you had to dig something out from the ground like they just did in Iran, trying to get rid of their nuclear weapons facilities there. So tactical nuclear weapons could mean
We don't have many. Pakistan has quite a few, about 50, and the Russians probably have 2,000, and they probably could use 600 or 700 on Europe, and probably would do that in a conflict, because France and Britain have nuclear weapons. Russia, as Obama said, is a tiny country, and it doesn't make anything anybody wants. Russia's a failing state. It's like North Korea is a failed state. There's one family there with money. Everybody else is starving. Russia is oligarchs. Like North Korea, they're putting all their money into military instead of putting it into boosting their economy and building things people want. So it's a failed state. It's moving toward failure. Most of their money comes from oil, which we don't want anymore because of the carbon dioxide problem. So that's very dangerous situation there in the future with Russia. And they might want to set off a tactical weapon to scare us more. Right now, Russia has two interesting things. It has a cruise missile that's nuclear powered that can fly around in the air forever. So they envision launching a bunch of these things and having them fly around in the air forever. They actually had one blow up a couple of years ago and kill a bunch of people. The other thing they have is they call it a torpedo. It's a drone submarine. We also have some. Their drone submarine is meant to have a gigantic bomb on it. They're going to put them in American harbors, and if they ever feel like it, they'll blow up a whole city with it. They just threatened to put one downwind of the UK about a year ago and told the Britain that if they didn't stop helping Ukraine, they blow it up downwind of Britain and contaminate the country with nuclear radiation. So that's another kind of single weapon explosion. That's a really large megaton weapon that they supposedly have there. They can be any size. The United States has, as I mentioned, five of them on some submarines. And those are low-yield weapons. I forgot what they are. I think they're like five.
Low-yield meaning?
5 kilotons or something. So they're about...
I mean, comparable to Hiroshima?
About a third of the Hiroshima bomb.
Okay.
A low-yield weapon like Hiroshima destroyed a whole city. Yeah. You know, so a low-yield atomic weapon isn't that safe. There's no point in using one in the Ukraine, for example, because unless you want to destroy one of the Ukrainian cities, they're of no military value. You've got a dispersed army there. The destructive range on one of these weapons, tiny little ones, is probably a quarter of a mile or half a mile or something. And so you're not going to really destroy an army that way. So it really wouldn't do any good to blow anything up unless you want to destroy a city, which, you know, they could do, or they could destroy power plants, which is, well, I won't get into whether these are against the rules of war, but there are a bunch of things in Ukraine that are against the law of war already.
Brian, how certain is your explanation of the death of the dinosaurs? And if that were incorrect, would it change your assessment of nuclear winter?
The smoke I mentioned and showed, described a picture of it, is in the same layer with the iridium. You know, so the iridium, the micrometeorites, probably fell out within a year. At least that's what our models suggest. We know how big they are. You know, they're sand-sized grains. You don't pick up sand, you throw it in the air, it falls right out. That's how fast they're falling. So they're not going to stay up very long. So that little layer of smoke from forest fires, you know, it's only millimeters thick, has not only got the smoke in it, it's also got the iridium in it. And, you know, so the iridium and the smoke had to have been generated in less than a year. Some people said, oh, well, the fires, they occurred centuries later as forests burned. That just isn't possible because of where these things are co-located. So I think we're pretty sure that smoke, which is still there from 66 million years ago, and it still looks the same as forest fire smoke, if you put that back in the atmosphere, that is, like I said, night and winter. I mean, it's not even winter. It's like totally black, like a moonless night. We know pretty well what's going to happen if you do that. It's just going to get colder and colder and colder. And the only thing that keeps it from getting really cold is the oceans. So the oceans have a lot of energy in them. And so the oceans slow down the cooling. So even these small wars are capable of driving things at really low temperatures, but the oceans stop them from doing it very rapidly. So I think we have a lot of confidence in what happened to the dinosaurs. It's much less easy to say what happened in a nuclear conflict, because it hasn't actually happened. You know, we don't know what would happen. I mean, I always get the question, which I got at lunch today, well, how about just one nuclear weapon? Well, we blew up 550 of them before 1963, and they didn't do anything. Of course, they were blown up over several years, and they weren't burned up in cities. People knew that they would start fires, so they blew them up in the desert or on islands in the Pacific or on islands off of Russia, so they wouldn't start these fires. The people knew they would start fires because Hiroshima burned to the ground. Nagasaki burned to the ground. So we know they will start fires. But you can argue about how much fuel is there in a modern city, how high does the smoke go, does it really go into the stratosphere? And so the uncertainties in this are on the front end. They're how much fuel is there in cities? It turns out that the average American has got something like 18 tons of fuel per person around them. So it's in your house, it's in the school your kid go to, it's in your grocery store, it's in this building, a lot of it is plastic. This is an actually important point, it has nothing to do with this. It used to be 10 years ago, if your fire alarm went off, you had like 10 minutes to get out of your house. Now the people who do this at NIST say you have 2 minutes to get out of your house before it flashes over and kills you. So basically, you've got a lot of gases there, they blow up, flash over. And the reason for that is all this plastic. This plastic is incredibly flammable. So if your fire alarm goes off, you get up and leave. Mine always goes off in the middle of the night. I think spiders crawl in the middle of the night, wake me up. You know, by the time I figured out what's happening, you know, it's too late probably. But you should take fire alarms very seriously. So a lot of this is about plastic, it's about oil. It's about the wood in buildings. You have 18 tons. Americans are about twice as much junk as Europeans have and Russians have. So fuel is an issue. How much it would burn is an issue. How much of the plastic would burn? How much black carbon is in the smoke is an issue. And how high it gets. Those are all a whole chain of issues. Then there's the climate models. I don't think they're much of an issue. On the other end are agricultural models. I think the agricultural models, we need more work there, especially in ultraviolet light, and we need more people to look at that problem. So the people I work with, there's about five of us, something like that, have been working on this problem since the 1980s. Carl Sagan was my thesis advisor, so he worked on this back in the early 1980s. And there was a lot of attention paid to it back then, from you can see from the quotes I gave you. And soon after that, NATO said, no one in NATO will ever study this problem. The Department of Defense said, no one in DOD will ever be funded to study this problem. They had a National Academy panel that I was on in the early 1980s, which was one of a whole string of them had been conducted to study environmental effects of nuclear wars. For decades. That one in the early 1980s was the last one for 40 years. I've spent 40 years trying to get the U.S. National Academy of Sciences to study this problem again. And we finally succeeded in that last year. And they just released a report about 2 months ago. How many people heard of the National Academy report on nuclear wars? One person. How many of you know that the United Nations voted to outlaw nuclear weapons? It is illegal to have nuclear. Wow, you're a really well-informed group. Almost no one in the United States knows that because nobody reported it in the United States except the New York Times had it in that paper once. Nuclear weapons are illegal worldwide, according to the United Nations. And you know how much attention we pay to the United Nations. So anyway, there's a lot of uncertainties in the front, uncertainties in the back. What did the National Academy study say? We should put a bunch of money in this and study it carefully. Because it's important to know what's going to happen and make sure politicians know that. So they advocated that NSF, NOAA, NASA, Department of Energy, and the Department of Defense fund studies at the present time to study this. What's the chance of that? The Trump administration is defunding NSF, is defunding NOAA, is defunding NASA, and is trying to defund the universities. So I'm not optimistic that there's going to be this study, which I've been trying to have happen for 40 years. Right now, the funding we have to work on this, which we just got in the last decade from some grants, comes from something called the Future of Life Institute. It's a foundation, so it's not governmental funding. A United Nations study just started up in the last few weeks. So the United Nations is now going to study this with a panel of about 20 people on it. So it's propagating upward in the political arenas now to worry about this problem. The Department of Defense does not want to hear about this. NATO does not want to hear this message. And we're trying to force them to hear the message. And so politicians are not irrational. You know, Donald Trump does not want to die. I think information transfer is the best thing we can do. It's not going to help us to go demonstrate in the streets. People will just ignore that. But I think if we can educate the people who can do something, that some of them might take it seriously.
You were just listening to Brian Toon on dinosaurs, extinctions, and nuclear war. He spoke in Boulder, Colorado in late August. Brian Toon is professor emeritus in the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences and the Laboratory for Atmospheric and Space Physics at the University of Colorado at Boulder. This program is produced by Alternative Radio, based in Boulder, Colorado. We're an independent nonprofit in our 40th year. We're supported solely by individuals just like you. We feature such voices as Chris Hedges, Gabor Mate, Roxanne Dunbar-Ortiz, and Noam Chomsky. To access our complete audio and book catalog, just go to our website, alternativeradio.org. Again, our website where we are podcasting, alternativeradio.org. For copies of today's program, Brian Toon on dinosaurs, extinctions, and nuclear war, and for the classic Howard Zinn book, You Can't Be Neutral on a Moving Train, call us 1-800-444-1977. That's 1-800-444-1977. Or go online, our website, alternativeradio.org. That's alternativeradio.org. Printed transcripts, PDFs, and MP3s of this program are free of charge. Just call us, 1-800-444-1977. Joe Ritchie is our general manager and editor. I'm David Barsamyan. Thank you for listening. We go out with Tom Lehrer singing, We Will All Go Together When We Go.
We will all go together when we go, all suffused with an incandescent glow. No one will have the endurance to collect on his insurance. Lloyd's of London will be loaded when they go. We will all fry together when we fry. We'll be French fried potatoes by and by. There will be no more misery when the world is our rotisserie. Yes, we all will fry together when we fry. We will all bake together when we bake. There'll be nobody present at the wake. With complete participation in that grand incineration, nearly 3 billion hunks of well-done steak. We will all char together when we char, and let there be no moaning of the bar. Just sing out a te deum when you see that ICBM, and the party will be come as you are. We will all burn together when we burn.
For those of us who still believe a non-capitalist future is both possible and necessary to save the planet, that there can be no socialism without decolonization. The fact is, the genocide persists precisely because the colonial order is still intact. On a global scale, it just takes on a different form or appearance. And so if we're going to fight and try to build that society, that world, we've got to basically understand that the fight against fascism is the fight against colonialism, is the fight against capitalism.
That's Robin D.G. Kelly, and this is Alternative Radio. I'm David Barsamyan. This edition of AR features Robin D.G. Kelly on colonialism, capitalism, and fascism. The era of traditional colonialism, with a few exceptions, is over, but it continues in new shapes and forms to have a profound influence and impact on former colonies all over the world. We are in the age of what may be called neo-colonialism. Former colonies are simultaneously independent and dependent. Neo-colonialism is a more insidious form of imperialism in which more powerful countries keep developing nations in a state of economic dependence. This dependent relationship is seen primarily in structural inequality, where the rich countries exploit the resources and labor of the poor. Colonialism fostered and institutionalized racist ideologies that continue to manifest in systemic racism. Robin D.G. Kelly says, "It's important to recognize that the consolidation of the modern colonial state and the rise of the fascist state occurred pretty much at the same time. The modern colonial state and the fascist state are both particular forms of capitalist states." Our guest today is Robin D.G. Kelly. He's professor of history at UCLA, a distinguished scholar, and award-winning author. Among his many books are Race Rebels, Thelonious Monk, and Freedom Dreams. He spoke at the Socialism 2025 conference in Chicago in July. And now, Robin.
Before we get started, I'd like to remind you that the view.